Chapter 16. The Subject of Negotiations. The morning sun sat on the horizon, leaving the nearer side of Tar Valon still wrapped in shadows, but the snow that covered everything gleamed brightly. The city itself seemed to shine behind its long white walls, all bravely towered and bannered, yet to Egwene, sitting her roan gelding on the riverbank above the city, it seemed even farther away than it really was. The Arranin widened to more than 2 miles here, and the Alendrella Arranin and Osandrella Arranin flowing to either side of the island were almost half that, so that Tar Valon appeared to sit in the middle of a great lake, unreachable despite the massive bridges that stood high above the waters so that ships could sail beneath them easily. The White Tower itself, a thick bone-white shaft rising to an impossible height from the city's heart, filled her own heart with a yearning for home. Not for the two rivers, but for the tower. That was her home now. A plume of smoke caught her eye, a faint black line rising from the far bank beyond the city, and she grimaced. Dyshar stamped a hoof in the snow, but a pat on the neck sufficed to soothe the roan. It would take more to soothe his rider. Homesickness was the smallest part of it, minuscule compared to the rest. With a sigh, she rested her reins on the high pommel of her saddle and raised the long, brass-bound looking-glass. Her cloak fell back, slipping off one shoulder, but she ignored the cold that misted her breath and placed a gloved hand to shield the front lens against the sun's glare. The city walls leapt closer in her sight. She focused on the tall, curving arms of North Harbor that pushed out into the upstream currents. People moved purposefully atop the battlements that enfolded the harbor, but she could barely discern men from women at that distance. Still, she was glad that she was not wearing her seven-striped stole, and that her face was deep within her cowl, just in case someone there had a stronger glass than she. The wide mouth of the man-made harbor was blocked by a massive iron chain drawn taut a few feet above the water. Tiny dots on the water, diving birds fishing in front of the harbor, gave the chain scale. One single pace-long link would have required 2 men to lift it. A rowboat might slip under that barrier, but no vessel of any size would enter unless the White Tower allowed. Of course, the chain was only intended to keep out enemies. "There they are, Mother," Lord Garrath murmured, and she lowered the glass. Her general was a stocky man in a plain breastplate worn over a plain brown coat, without any touch of gilt or embroidery anywhere. His face was bluff and weathered behind the bars of his helmet, and the years had given him a strange sort of comforting calmness. All you need do was look at Garrath Bryn to know that if the pit of doom opened in front of him, he would smother his fear and go about doing what needed doing, and other men would follow him. He had proved on battlefield after battlefield that following him was the path to victory. A good man to have following her. Her eyes followed his gauntleted hand pointing upriver. Just coming in sight around a point of land, 5, 6, no, 7 river ships were slicing furrows down the Arranin. Large vessels, as such things were seen on the river, one with 3 masts, their triangular sails stood out tight, and their long sweeps cut hard through the blue-green water to add a little more speed. Everything about the craft spoke of a burning desire for speed, a desire to reach Tar Valon now. The river was deep enough here that ships could run within shouting distance of the banks in places, but these sailed in almost single file as close to the middle of the Arranin as the steersmen could manage and hold the wind. Sailors clinging to the mastheads kept watch along the shoreline, and not for mudbanks. In fact, they had nothing at all to fear so long as they kept out of bowshot. True, from where she sat her horse, she could have set fire to every one of those ships, or simply cut holes through their hulls and let them sink, the work of moments. Yet doing so surely meant some of those aboard would drown. The currents were strong, the water like ice, and the swim to shore long, for those who actually could swim. Even 1 death would make what she did, using the power as a weapon, She was trying to live as though already bound by the three oaths, and the oaths protected those vessels from her or any other sister. A sister who had sworn on the oath rod would not be able to make herself set those weaves, perhaps not even to form them, unless she could convince herself she was in immediate danger from the ships. But neither captains nor crews believed that, apparently. As the river ships came closer, shouts thinned to threadbare by distance drifted across the water. The lookouts up on the masts pointed to her and Gareth, and it quickly became apparent they took her for an Aes Sedai with her warder. Or at least the captains were unwilling to take the chance she was not. After a moment the beat of the sweeps increased. Only by a fraction, but the oarsmen labored to find that fraction. A woman on the quarterdeck of the lead vessel, likely the captain, waved her arms as if demanding still more effort, and a handful of men began running up and down the deck, tightening this line or loosening that to change the angle of the sails, though Egwene could not see that they achieved anything. There were men on those decks other than sailors, and most of those crowded to the railings, a handful raising looking glasses of their own. Some seemed to be measuring the distance left to cover before they reached the safety of the harbor. She thought about weaving a flare, a starburst of light, perhaps with a loud bang, just above each of the vessels. That would certainly let anyone aboard with brains realize that neither speed nor distance kept them safe here, only a forbearance born of the three oaths. They should know that they were safe because of Aes Sedai. Exhaling heavily, she shook her head and mentally upbraided herself. That simple weave would also attract attention in the city, certainly more than the appearance of a single sister. Sisters often came to the riverbank to stare at Tar Valon and the tower. Even if the only reaction to her flares was some sort of counter-display, once begun, that sort of contest could be very difficult to put a stop to. Once begun, matters might well escalate out of hand. There were too many opportunities for that, as it was, the more so these last 5 days.
The harbor master hasn't let above 8 or 9 ships in at one time since we arrived, Gareth said as the first vessel drew abreast of them. But the captain seemed to have worked out the timing. Another clutch will appear soon and reach the city about the time the tower guards are sure these fellows actually came to enlist. Jimar Chubain knows enough to guard against me sneaking men in aboard ships. He has more of the guards crowded into the harbors than anywhere except at the bridge towers, and not many anywhere else, so far as I can learn. That will change, though. The flow of ships starts at first light and keeps up till near nightfall, here and at South Harbor, too. This lot doesn't seem to be carrying as many soldiers as most do. Every plan is brilliant until the day comes, Mother, but then you must adapt to circumstances or be ridden down.
Egwene made a vexed sound. There must be 200 or more passengers altogether on those 7 ships. A few might be merchants or traders or some other sort of innocent traveler, but the low sun glittered off helmets and breastplates and steel discs sewn to leather jerkins. How many shiploads arrived each day? Whatever the number, a steady flow was pouring into the city to enlist under High Captain Chubain. Why do men always rush so hard to kill or be killed? She muttered irritably. Lord Gareth looked at her calmly. He sat his horse, a big bay gelding with a white stripe down his nose, like a statue. Sometimes she thought she knew one small part of how Swan felt about the man. Sometimes she thought it would be worth whatever effort was needed to startle him just to see him startled. Unfortunately, she knew the answer to her own question as well as he did, at least as it applied to men going soldiering. Oh, there were men enough who rushed to support a cause or defend what they thought was right, and some who sought adventure, whatever they believed that was. Yet the simple fact was that for carrying a pike or spear, a man could earn twice each day what he would get for walking behind another man's plow, and half again as much if he could ride well enough to join the cavalry. Crossbowmen and archers fell in between. The man who worked for another could dream of having his own farm or shop one day, or a beginning toward one that his sons could build on. But he surely had heard a thousand tales of men soldiering for 5 years or 10, and coming home with enough gold to set themselves up in comfort. Tales of ordinary men who rose to become generals or lords. For a poor man, Gareth had said bluntly, staring down the point of a pike could be a better view than the hind end of somebody else's plough horse. Even if he was far more likely to die from the pike than earn fame or fortune. A bitter way to look at it, yet she imagined that was how most of those men on the ships saw matters too. But then, that was how she had gotten her own army. For every man who wanted to see the usurper pulled from the Ammerland seat, for every man who even knew for certain who Elida was, 10, if not 100, had joined for the pay. Some of the men on the ship were raising their hands to show the guards on the harbor walls they were not holding weapons. No, she said, and Lord Gareth sighed. His voice remained calm, but his words were hardly comforting when he spoke. Mother, so long as the harbors remain open, Tar-Valon will eat better than we do, and rather than growing weaker with hunger, the Tower Guard will grow larger and stronger. I very much doubt that Elida will let Chewbane rush out to attack us, as much as I wish he would. Every day you wait only adds to the butcher's bill we'll have to pay sooner or later. I've said from the start it will come to an assault in the end, and that hasn't changed, but everything else has. Have the sisters put me and my men inside the walls now, and I can take Tar-Valon. It won't be clean, it never is, but I can take the city for you, and fewer will die than if you delay. A knot formed in her belly, twisted tight till she could hardly breathe. Carefully, step by step, she performed novice exercises to make it loosen. The bank contained the river, guiding without controlling. Calm settled on her, in her. Too many people had begun seeing the uses of gateways, and in a way, Gareth represented the worst. His business was war, and he was very good at it. As soon as he learned a gateway could take more than a small group of people at one time, he had seen the implications. Even the great walls of Tar-Valon, beyond the range of any siege catapult not on a barge, and worked with the power till the largest catapult could not mark them in any case, might as well be made of paper against an army that could travel. But whether Gareth Bryn had learned or not, other men would seize on that idea. The Ashaman already had, it seemed. War had always been ugly, yet it was going to grow uglier. No, she repeated. I know people are going to die before this is over. The light helper, she could see them dying just by closing her eyes. Even more would die if she made the wrong decisions, though, and not just here. But I have to keep the White Tower alive, against Tarman Gaiden, to stand between the world and the Ashaman. And the tower will die if this comes to sisters killing one another in the streets of Tar-Valon. That had already happened once. It could not be allowed a second time. If the White Tower dies, hope dies. I shouldn't have to tell you that again. Dyshar snorted and tossed his head, lunging as though he had sensed her irritation. But she reined him in firmly and slipped the looking glass into the tooled leather case hanging from her saddle. The diving birds gave up their fishing and sprang into the air as the thick chain that blocked North Harbor began to droop. It would dip beneath the surface well before the first ship reached the harbor mouth. How long ago had it been that she reached Tar-Valon by that same route? Almost beyond memory, it seemed. An age gone. It had been another woman who came ashore and was met by the Mistress of Novices. Gareth shook his head with a quick grimace, but then he never gave up, did he? You have to keep the White Tower alive, Mother, but my job is to give it to you. Unless things have changed that I don't know about. I can see sisters whispering and looking over their shoulders, even if I don't know what it means. If you still want the tower, it will come to an assault. Better soon than late. Suddenly the morning seemed darker, as though clouds had obscured the sun. Whatever she did, the dead were going to pile up like cordwood. But she had to keep the White Tower alive. She had to. when there were no good choices, you had to choose the one that seemed least wrong. I've seen enough here, she said quietly. With one last glance at that narrow line of smoke beyond the city, she turned Dyshar toward the trees 100 paces back from the river, where her escort waited among the evergreen leatherleaf and winterbare beech and birch. 200 light cavalry in boiled leather breastplates or coats covered with metal discs would certainly have attracted notice appearing on the riverbank, but Gareth had convinced her of the necessity of these men with their slender lances and short horse bows. Without any doubt, that smoke plume on the far bank rose from burning wagons or supplies. Pinpricks, yet those pinpricks came every night, sometimes one, sometimes two or three, till everyone looked for smoke first thing on rising. Hunting the raiders down had proved impossible so far. Sudden snow squalls flared around the pursuers, or fierce freezing night winds, or the tracks simply vanished abruptly, the snow beyond the last hoof print as smooth as fresh fallen. The residues of weavings made it plain enough they were being aided by Aes Sedai, and there was no point in taking a chance that Elida had men and maybe sisters on this side of the river, too. Few things could please Elida more than getting her hands on Egwene Alvear. They were not her whole escort, of course. Besides Shiriam, her keeper, she had ridden out with 6 more Aes Sedai this morning, and those who had warders had brought them, so behind the sister 8 men waited in color-shifting cloaks that rippled in queasy-making fashion when a breeze caught them, and otherwise made parts of riders and horses seem to vanish into the tree trunks. Aware of the dangers, from raiders at least, aware that their Aes Sedai were wound tight to near breaking, they watched the surrounding copse as though the cavalrymen were not there. The safety of their own Aes Sedai was their primary concern, and that they trusted to no one else. Saren, a black-bearded stump of a man, not that short but very wide, stayed so close to Nissau that he seemed to loom over the diminutive yellow. And Jory managed to loom over Morvryn as well, though he was actually shorter than she. As broad as Saren, but very short, even for a Kyrianan. Mirel's 3 warders, the 3 she dared acknowledge, clustered around her until she could not have moved her horse without pushing one of theirs out of her way. Anaya's Setagana, lean and dark and as beautiful as she was plain, almost managed to surround her by himself. And Tervail, with his bold nose and scarred face, did the same with Beonin. Carlinia had no warder, not unusual for a white, but she studied the men from the depths of her fur-lined cowl as if thinking about finding one. Not too long ago, Egwene would have hesitated to be seen with those 6 women. They and Shiriam had all sworn fealty to her for various reasons, and neither they nor she wanted the fact known or even suspected. They had been her way to influence events, to the extent that she could, when everyone thought her no more than a figurehead, a girl Amerlin the Hall of the Tower could use as it wished and no one listened to. The Hall had lost that illusion when she brought them to declare war on Elida, finally admitting what they had been about since the day they had fled the tower in the first place. But that only made the Hall and the Ajahs worry over what she would do next and try to figure out how to make sure that whatever it was met with their approval. The sitters had been very surprised when she accepted their suggestion of a council, 1 sister from each Ajah, to advise her with their wisdom and experience. Or perhaps they thought her success with the declaration of war had gone to her head. Of course, she had just told Morvryn and Anaya and the others to make sure they were the sisters chosen, and they retained enough prestige within their Ajahs to manage it. Just. She had been listening to their advice, if not always taking it, for weeks by that time. But now there was no longer any need to arrange furtive meetings or pass messages in secret. It seemed, however, that there had been an addition to the party while Egwene was staring at the tower. Shiriam, wearing the narrow blue stole of her office outside her cloak, managed a very formal bow from her saddle. The flame-haired woman could be incredibly formal at times. "Mother, the sitter Dalana wishes to speak with you," she said, as if Egwene could not see the stout gray sister sitting there on a dappled mare almost as dark as Shiriam's black-footed mount. On a matter of some importance, so she says. And the slight touch of asperity meant Delana had not told her what matter. Shiriam would not have liked that. She could be very jealous of her position. "In private, if you please, mother," Delana said, pushing back her dark hood to reveal hair nearly the color of silver. Her voice was deep for a woman's, but it hardly carried the urgency of someone with important matters to speak of. Her presence was something of a surprise. Delana often supported Egwene in the hall of the tower when sitters were quibbling over whether a particular decision actually concerned the war against Elida. That meant the hall was required to support Egwene's commands as if they had stood with the greater consensus. And even the sitters who had stood for war did not half like that little fact, which made for endless quibbling. They wanted to pull Elida down, yet left to themselves the hall would have done nothing but argue. Truth to tell, though, Delana's support was not always welcome. One day she could be the very image of a gray negotiator seeking consensus, and the next so strident in her arguments that every sitter within hearing got her back up. She had been known to set the cat among the pigeons in other ways, too. No fewer than 3 times now she had demanded the hall make a formal declaration that Elida was Black Aja, which inevitably led to an awkward silence until someone called for the sitting to be adjourned. Few were willing to discuss the Black Aja openly. Delana would discuss anything, from how they were to find proper clothes for 987 novices, to whether Elida had secret supporters among the sisters, another topic that gave most sisters a case of the prickles. Which left the question of why she had ridden out so early and by herself. She had never approached Egwene before without another sitter or three for company. Delana's pale blue eyes gave away no more than did her smooth Aes Sedai face. "While we ride," Egwene told her. "We will want a little privacy," she added when Shiriam opened her mouth. "Stay back with the others, please." The keeper's green eyes tightened in what might almost have been anger. An efficient keeper, and eager with it, she had pinned her hopes on Egwene and made little secret that she disliked being excluded from any meeting Egwene had. Upset or not, she bowed her head in acceptance with only a small hesitation. Shiriam had not always known which of them commanded, but she did now. The land tended upward from the River Arinon, not in hills, but simply rising toward the monstrous peak that loomed to the west, so massive it seemed to mock the name Mountain. Dragon Mount would have towered above everything else, even in the spine of the world. In the relatively flat country around Tarvalen, its white-capped crest seemed to reach the heavens, especially when a thin thread of smoke was streaming away from the jagged top as it was now. A thin thread at that height would be something else entirely close at hand. Trees gave out less than halfway up Dragon Mount, and no one had ever succeeded in reaching the crest or even coming close, though it was said the slopes were littered with the bones of those who had tried. Why anyone would try in the first place, no one could quite explain. Sometimes the long evening shadow of the mountain stretched all the way to the city. People who lived in the region were accustomed to Dragon Mount dominating the sky, much as they were accustomed to the White Tower looming above the city walls and visible for miles. Both were unchanging fixtures that had always been there and always would be. But crops and crafts occupied the people's lives, not mountains or Aes Sedai. In tiny hamlets of 10 or 12 stone houses roofed in thatch or slate, and the occasional village of 100, children playing in the snow or carrying buckets of water from the wells stopped to gape at the soldiers riding along the dirt tracks that passed for roads when not covered in snow. They carried no banners, but a few of the soldiers wore the flame of Tarvalen worked on their cloaks or coat sleeves, and the warders' strange cloaks named at least some of the women as Aes Sedai. Even this near the city, sisters had been an uncommon sight till recently, and they were still something to make a child's eyes gleam. But then the soldiers themselves probably came close in the list of marvels. The farms that fed Tarvalin covered most of the land, stone-walled fields surrounding sprawling houses and tall barns of stone or brick, with copses and coppices and thickets of trees between, and groups of farm children often ran a little distance parallel to the line of travel, leaping across the snow like hares. Winter chores kept most older folk indoors, but those who ventured out, heavily bundled against the cold, spared barely a glance for soldiers or warders or Aes Sedai. Spring would be coming soon, and the ploughing and planting, and what Aes Sedai did would not affect that. The light willing, it would not. There was no point to guards unless they rode as if expecting an attack, and Lord Garth had arranged a strong party of fore-riders and lines of flankers, with trailers riding to the rear, while he led the mass of the soldiers right behind the warders, who followed closely on the heels of Shiriam and the council. They all made a large, lopsided ring around Egwene, and she could almost imagine she was riding through the countryside alone with Delanna, if she did not look around too closely, or if she looked beyond. Instead of pressing the grey sitter to speak, it was a long ride back to camp, and no one was allowed to weave a gateway where the weave might be observed. There was plenty of time to hear what Delanna had to say. Egwene compared the farms they passed to those in the Two Rivers. Perhaps the realization that the Two Rivers was no longer home made her study them. Acknowledging the truth could never be a betrayal, yet she needed to remember the Two Rivers. You could forget who you were if you forgot where you came from, and sometimes the innkeeper's daughter from Emmons Field seemed a stranger to her. Any of these farms would have looked decidedly odd set down near Emmons Field, though she could not put a finger on why exactly. A different shape to the houses, a different slant to the roofs. And more often slate topped a house than thatch here, when you could make out either through the snow that was often mounded on the rooftops. Of course there was less thatch and more stone and brick in the Two Rivers now than there had been. She had seen it in Telairun Riod. Change came so slowly you never noticed it creeping up on you, or far too fast for comfort. But it came. Nothing stayed the same, even when you thought it did, or hoped it would. "Some think you're going to bond him your warder," Delanna said suddenly in a quiet voice. She might have been engaging in casual conversation. Her whole attention seemed to be on arranging the hood of her cloak with green-gloved hands. She rode well, blending with the motion of her mare so effortlessly that she appeared unaware of the animal. "Some think perhaps you already have. I haven't had one myself for some time, but just knowing your warder is there can be a comfort, if you choose the right one." Egwene raised an eyebrow. She was proud that she did not gape at the woman. This was the very last topic she would have expected. And Delanna added, "Lord Garrus, he spends a great deal of time with you. He's rather older than is usual, but greens often choose a more experienced man for their first. I know you never actually had an Aja, yet I often think of you as a green. I wonder, will Swan be relieved if you bond him, or upset? Sometimes I think one, sometimes the other. Their relationship, if it can be called that, is most peculiar, yet she seems completely unembarrassed." "You must ask Swan herself about that." Egwene's smile had some bite in it. So did her tone, for that matter. She did not entirely understand herself why Gareth Bryn had offered her his loyalty, but the Hall of the Tower had better uses for its time than gossiping like village women. "You can tell whoever you choose that I've bonded no one, Delanna. Lord Gareth spends time with me, as you put it, because I am the Armerlin and he is my general. You may remind them of that as well." So Delanna thought of her as a green. That was the Aja she would have chosen, though in truth she wanted only one warder. But Gawain was either inside Tarvalin or else on his way to Camelin, and either way she would not lay hands on him soon. She patted Dyshar's neck unnecessarily, and tried to keep her smile from becoming a glare. It had been pleasant to forget the hall, among other things, for a while. The hall made her understand why Swan had so often looked like a bear with a sore tooth when she was Armerlin.
"I wouldn't say it has become a matter for wide discussion," Delana murmured, "so far. Still, there is some interest in whether you will bond a warder and who. I doubt that Gareth Bryn would be considered a wise pick."
She twisted in her saddle to look behind them. At Lord Gareth, Egwene thought. But when the sitter turned back around, she said very softly, "Shiriam was never your choice for keeper, of course. But you must know that the Ajahs set the rest of that lot to watch you as well." Her dappled gray mare was shorter than Dyshar, so she had to look up at Egwene, which she tried to do without seeming to. Those watery blue eyes were suddenly quite sharp. "There was some thought that Swan might be advising you too well after the way you brought about the declaration of war against Elida. But she's still resentful over her changed circumstances, isn't she? Shiriam is seen as the most likely culprit now. In any case, the Ajahs want a little warning if you decide to pull another surprise."
"I thank you for the warning," Egwene said politely.
"Culprit?" She had proven to the hall that she would not be their puppet, yet most insisted on thinking she had to be someone's. At least no one suspected the truth about her counsel. It was to be hoped no one did. "There is another reason you should be wary," Delana went on, the intensity in her eyes belying the casualness of her voice. This was more important to her than she wanted Egwene to know. "You may be sure that any advice one of them gives you comes straight from the head of her Ajah. And as you know, the head of an Ajah and its sitters don't always see eye to eye. Listening too closely could put you at odds with the hall. Not every decision concerns the war, remember, but you will surely want some of those to go your way."
"An Armerlin should listen to every side before making any decision," Egwene replied. "But I'll remember your warning when they advise me, daughter."
Did Delana think she was a fool? Or perhaps the woman was trying to make her angry? Anger made for hasty decisions and rash words that sometimes were hard to take back. She could not imagine what Delana was aiming at, but when sitters could not manipulate her one way, they tried another. She had gotten a great deal of practice in sidestepping manipulation since being raised Armerlin. Taking deep, regular breaths, she sought the balance of calm and found it. She had entirely too much practice at that, too, of late. The gray looked up at her past the edge of her hood, her face utterly smooth. But her pale blue eyes were very sharp now, like augers. "You might inquire what they think on the subject of negotiations with Elida, Mother." Egwene almost smiled. The pause had been very deliberate. Apparently Delana disliked being called daughter by a woman younger than most novices, younger than most who had come from the tower, let alone the newest. But then Delana herself was too young to be a sitter, and she could not hold her temper as well as the innkeeper's daughter.
"And why would I ask that?"
"Because the subject has come up in the hall in the last few days. Not as a proposal, but it has been mentioned very quietly by Varalyn and by Takima and also by Magla. And Faisella and Saroya have appeared interested in what they have had to say."
Calm or no calm, a worm of anger suddenly writhed inside Egwene, and crushing it was no easy task. Those five had been sitters before the tower was broken, but more importantly, they were divided between the two major factions struggling for control of the hall. In reality, they were divided between following Romanda or Lelaine, yet that pair would oppose one another if it meant they both drowned. They also kept an iron grip on their followers. She might believe the others had been panicked by events, but not Romanda or Lelaine. For half a week now, talk of Elida or retaking the tower had been all but overwhelmed by worried conversations over that impossibly powerful, impossibly long eruption of the power. Nearly everyone wanted to learn what had caused it,
and nearly everyone was afraid to learn. Only yesterday had Egwene been able to convince the hall that it must be safe for a small party to travel to where that eruption had been. Even the memory was strong enough for everyone to pinpoint exactly where it had been. And most sisters still seemed to be holding their collective breath until Akarin and the others returned. Every Aja had wanted a representative, but Akarin had been the only Aes Sedai to push forward. Neither Lelaine nor Romanda seemed concerned, however. Violent and prolonged as the display had been, it also had been very far away, and no harm done that they could see. If it was the Forsaken's work, as seemed certain, the chance of learning anything was vanishingly small, and the possibility that they could do anything to counter it even smaller. Wasting time and effort on impossibilities was senseless when an important task lay right in front of them. So they said, gritting their teeth over finding themselves in agreement. They did agree that Elida must be stripped of the stolen staff, though, Romanda with almost as much fervor as Lelaine, and if Elida unseating a former Blue as Amarlin had enraged Lelaine, Elida's proclamation that the Blue Aja was disbanded had made her near rabid. If they were allowing talk of negotiation, it made no sense. The last thing Egwene wanted was for Delana or anyone else to suspect that Shiriam and the others were more than a set of sheepdogs set to watch her, but she summoned them with a sharp call. They were smart enough to keep the secrets that needed keeping, since their own Ajas would have their hides if even the half came out, and with no great haste they came forward and rode in a cluster around her, their faces all masks of Aes Sedai serenity and patience. Then Egwene told Delana to repeat what she had said. For all her initial request for privacy, the Grey made only a perfunctory demurral before complying. And that was the end of calm and patience.
"That's madness," Shiriam said before anyone else could open her mouth. She sounded angry and perhaps a little frightened.
Well, she might be. Her name was on a list of those marked for stilling.
None of them can really believe negotiation is possible.
I should hardly think so, Anaya put in dryly. Her plain face belonged on a farm wife rather than a Blue sister, and she dressed very simply, publicly at least, in good wool, but she handled her bay gelding as easily as Delana did her mare. Very little could ruffle Anaya's calm. Of course, there was no Blue among the sitters talking negotiation. Anaya looked an unlikely soldier, but for Blues this was war to the knife, no quarter asked or given.
Elida has made the situation quite clear.
Elida is irrational, Carlinia said, with a toss of her head that made her cowl fall to her shoulders and shook her short dark curls. She pulled the hood back into place irritably. Carlinia seldom showed any hint of emotion, yet her pale cheeks were nearly as flushed as Shiriam's, and heat filled her voice.
She cannot possibly believe that we will all come crawling back to her now. How can Saroya believe she will accept anything less?
Crawling is what Elida has demanded, though, Morvryn muttered acridly.
Her usually placid round face wore a sour expression, too, and her plump hands were tight on her reins. She scowled so hard at a flight of magpies scattering from a stand of birch trees at the passage of horses that it seemed they should fall out of the sky.
Takima likes the sound of her own voice sometimes. She must be talking to hear herself.
Faisella must, too, Mirel said darkly, glaring at Delana as though she were to blame. The olive-skinned woman was known for her temper, even among greens.
I never expected to hear that sort of talk out of her. She's never been a fool before.
I can't believe Magla really means any such thing, Nisao insisted, peering at each of them in turn. She just can't. For one thing, much as I hate to say it, Romanda has Magla so tight under her thumb that Magla squeaks whenever Romanda sneezes. And the only doubt Romanda has is whether Elida should be birched before she's exiled.
Delana's expression was so bland, she had to be suppressing a smug smile. Plainly, this was exactly the reaction she had hoped for.
Romanda holds Saroya and Varalyn just as firmly,
and Takima and Faisella hardly put one foot in front of the other without Lelaine's permission. But they still said what they said. I think your advisers are closer to the feelings of most sisters, though, Mother.
Smoothing her gloves, she gave Egwene a sidelong look.
You may be able to nip this in the bud if you move firmly. It seems you will have the support you need from the Ajahs. And mine, of course, in the hall. Mine and enough more to stop it dead.
As if Egwene needed support to accomplish that. Perhaps she was trying to ingratiate herself. Or just to make it appear that support of Egwene was her only concern.
Bayonin had been riding in silence, clutching her cloak around her and peering at a spot between her brown mare's ears, but suddenly she shook her head. Ordinarily, her large blue-gray eyes made her appear startled, but they peered from her hood in a blaze of anger as she glared from one of her companions to another, including Egwene.
"Why should negotiations be out of the question?"
Shiriam blinked at her in surprise, and Morvryn opened her mouth with a scowl, but Bayonin plunged on, directing her ire at Delana now, her Taraboner accent stronger than usual.
"We are Greys, you and I. We negotiate, mediate. Elida, she has stated the conditions most onerous, but that is often the case in the beginning of negotiations. We can reunite the White Tower and assure the safety of everyone if we only talk."
"We also judge," Delana snapped. "And Elida has been judged." That was not precisely true, but she seemed more startled than anyone else by Bayonin's outburst. Her voice dripped acid. "Perhaps you are willing to negotiate yourself into being birched. I am not, and I think you will find few others who are either."
"The situation, it has altered," Bayonin persisted.
She stretched a hand toward Egwene, almost pleading.
"Elida would not have made the proclamation she did concerning the dragon reborn unless she had him in hand, one way or another. That flare of Sidar was a warning. The Forsaken must be moving, and the White Tower, it must be—"
"Enough," Egwene cut in. "You are willing to open negotiations with Elida? With the sitters still in the tower?" she amended.
"Elida would never talk."
"Yes," Bayonin said fervently. "Matters can be arranged to everyone's satisfaction. I know they can."
"Then you have my permission."
Immediately, everyone but Bayonin began talking frantically on top of one another, trying to dissuade her, telling her this was insanity. Anaya shouted as loudly as Shiriam, gesturing emphatically, and Delana's eyes bulged in what looked like near terror. Some of the outriders began looking toward the sisters as much as they watched the farms they were riding past, and there was a stir among the warders, who certainly had no need of their bonds at the moment to know their Aes Sedai were agitated, but they held their places. Wise men kept their noses out of the way when Aes Sedai began raising their voices. Egwene ignored the shouts and arm-waving. She had considered every possibility she could think of for ending this struggle with the White Tower whole and united. She had talked for hours with Swan, who had more reason than anyone to want to unseat Elida. If it could have saved the tower, Egwene would have surrendered to Elida, forget whether the woman had come to the Ammerlin seat legally. Swan had nearly had apoplexy at the suggestion, yet she had agreed reluctantly that preserving the tower superseded every other consideration. Bayonin wore such a beautiful smile. It seemed a crime to quench it. Egwene raised her voice just enough to be heard over the others. "You will approach Varalyn and the others Delana named and arrange to approach the White Tower. These are the terms I will accept. Elida is to resign and go into exile, because Elida would never accept back the sisters who had rebelled against her. An Ammerlin had no say over how an Aja governed itself, but Elida had declared that the sisters who fled the tower were no longer members of any Aja. According to her, they would have to beg readmittance to their Ajas after serving a penance under her direct control. Elida would not reunite the tower, only shatter it worse than it already was.
Those are the only terms I will accept, Bayonin. The only terms. Do you understand me?"
Bernin's eyes rolled up in her head, and she would have fallen from her horse if Morvryn had not caught her, muttering under her breath as she held the grey upright and slapped her face. Not lightly. Everyone else stared at Egwene as though they had never seen her before. Even Delanna, who must have planned for something like this to happen from the first word she had said. They had come to a halt with Bannon's fainting fit, and the ring of soldiers around them drew up at a shouted command from Lord Gareth. Some stared toward the Aes Sedai, their anxiety plain, even with their faces hidden behind the bars of their helmets. "It's time to get back to camp," Egwene said, calmly. What had to be done had to be done. Perhaps surrender would have healed the tower, but she could not believe it. And now it might come down to Aes Sedai facing one another in the streets of Tar Valon, unless she could find a way to make her plan succeed. "We have work to do," she said, gathering her reins, "and there isn't much time left." She prayed there was enough.